Welcome to this week's episode of The Boundless Show. It is a sunny day in Colorado Springs, and hopefully it is where you are as well. For this week's show, we will be featuring, first off, the second half of Candace and my discussion with Julie Slattery, Straight Talk for Single Women. You heard the first part last week, so we will continue that discussion this week, maybe with a little more passion and maybe a couple tears. But that's what happens when you're single and you're just talking about it. So anyway, that is on this week's show, as well as an interview with Dr. Al Mohler. He was here at Focus on the Family this week for board meetings, and we snagged him and brought him into the studio to talk about Christians and new media. So you're certainly going to want to hear that. And then we're going to finish up with our inbox today, talking to a young man about getting married in the middle of an economic downturn. And if you don't have a job that maybe can support yourself and or a wife and family, should you still pursue marriage? Probably the first thing you should do is start writing books like Al Mohler, but we might offer that as part of our advice. Anyway, that is this week's show, and here we go to the second half of Straight Talk for Single Women.
When we look at Scripture and it talks about marriage, there are these practical things that marriage kind of bring to us, be companionship and partnership and even economics and living in a house and creating children. But the ultimate purpose of marriage, according to Scripture, is to show us what an intimacy with Jesus looks like and to kind of mirror that passion that Jesus has for his bride. Mm-hmm. And even the sexual union has something spiritual that we're not quite sure what that is, but it's supposed to give us an idea of what union with God will look like. Now, my concern sometimes with a woman just really leaning into longings that she has for marriage is she's looking at the reflection and forgetting what the reflection is supposed to show, which is a longing ultimately for intimacy with God.
Again, my concern is that what I see more often than that is people who dishonor marriage altogether because they're so frustrated that they don't have it, they get bitter and angry. And so they feel like if I can somehow tear marriage down and bring it down a notch, I'll feel better about the fact that I don't have it. And so that's the greater concern I have and why when I've talked about marriage, it's unlikely marriage would become an idol. Because marriage, as God designed it, is actually the antidote to so much of the idolatry we see in our culture. It's the antidote to all the sexual promiscuity, or it can be, if marriage is done the way God designed it. Again, that's what we're talking about, is marriage as God intended it, not marriage in the way the world sees it or you know, marriage in our own image.
I think my opinion on that is that I see, you know, whatever marriage is going to provide or the relationship within marriage, single women have the chance of elevating it too much and married women have the chance to, because the fact is that none of your, you know, there are certain needs that are only going to be met through Christ, whether you're single or whether you're married. And I think that, you know, I'm in a study right now where we talked about, I saw one of the chapters was being married to Christ. And my first reaction was, oh, here we go again. This is going to be the panacea for all the single women out there. But it's so true because I think of all the things to myself that marriage does provide. And when you think of just general like financial things, but also companionship, protection, someone who's an advocate for you, someone who knows you intimately and loves you intimately. That is stuff that all needs to be found in Christ. And Christ is my ultimate vindicator. Christ is my ultimate. I mean, there are, you know, through heartbreak and through the lessons I've learned and through everything, Jesus Christ is the only one who's met me through every life stage. Everyone else is coming and going. And so I think that, married women have to realize that too, and often do just during the course of their marriage that, oh my goodness, I wanted my husband to be this and he's not.
Oh, yeah. Well, I really agree that married women can make marriage, their husbands, their children, family in general, idols. And I think we see that throughout the New Testament. Why does Jesus on several occasions choose the family and say, make sure this doesn't become more important than I am? Mm-hmm. You know, why does he say, if you love your husband or wife more than me, or your son or daughter, or mother and father, you're not worthy of me?
Again, though, Julie, we are talking at Boundless anyway to a generation of young men who don't make it important enough. Mm-hmm. We so rarely see that problem. We don't have any men calling the Boundless show saying,
I think I agree with you on men. I really do. I think that's less of a problem with men, but I see it an awful lot in women. In single and married women,
mm-hmm.
that their hope is, secretly, maybe they don't voice it so much, but the hope is, if only I can get married, if only I can have kids, I'll be complete. And then once it happens, there's all this energy and focus and everything placed on, if only my marriage is better, if only my kids behave, then I'll be complete. And marriage and family and kids, I mean, they're what a gift from God. But I think the warning in Scripture, particularly out of Jesus' own mouth, that very gift can actually become more important than being my disciple.
That's like saying, though, that it's almost like you're talking about women's relationship to marriage the way we would talk about an anorexic's relationship to food. God gave us the bread of life. He is the bread of life, and we have the blood as the wine. And yet we still eat breakfast. You probably had breakfast and lunch, right? I mean, he gives us natural food to meet a natural craving. Mm. And he gives us marriage to meet certain natural needs. Mm-hmm. And so I think we just have to be careful not to diminish marriage in the process of saying, Jesus is your all. It's one of those mysteries.
I think it is. You're coming at it. We have to be careful not to diminish marriage so that it doesn't become too important. But I'd say, on the other hand, I think we have to be careful as we elevate marriage not to elevate it so high that we watch out for that trap.
It's just so hard to imagine that in the culture we live in. Marriage is under attack everywhere. I mean, the divorce epidemic, the homosexuals demanding that they be able to have this union and completely redefining what it is, what the world needs now, right, in addition to love, sweet love, are people who are marrying in the way God designed it so that they really are a picture of Christ in the church.
Well, I think maybe as a culture it's hard to see that, but in individual lives I think it's really easy to see it. You know, I struggle in my own heart with elevating my children or elevating my marriage above my walk with Christ.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it comes to offending my husband or speaking a truth that God wants me to speak or taking a stand, in some ways it's much easier for me to stand with my husband than it is to put that relationship on the altar and stand for truth. So I think in our individual lives, it can be very easy to choose the people that are closest to us above choosing what God would call us to.
Yeah, I kind of see that as just being an indicator of how spiritually tepid we are in general. I mean, I see, you know, whether we're talking about relationships or whatever, we're always going to go to the easiest fix that we can find, the thing that's right in front of us, the people, the things, the situations that we feel can satisfy our needs. And it's just, you know, the age-old problem of we're not returning to Christ. We're not going where we need to go for what we need. And anything can, you know, crop up and become that thing for us, but it's ultimately not going to satisfy.
Mm-hmm. And I read, the Psalms. And when you read the Psalms, you know, David was such a passionate man. And you know that he was married and more than once. And we see some problems with his marriage with Michal, but we can presume that he had a good marriage with Abigail. But yet we see him just laying out his heart to God and this intimacy with God and these emotions that he expresses through the Psalms and his walk with God, you know, it was so incredible that it's maybe a good way that we think about it, that we're not diminishing marriage, but we're making sure that our first intimacy starts with God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a tough balance.
Well, and I think that is the heart of a healthy marriage, are two people who are so completely devoted to walking out their faith with the Lord. And it's a marriage of three. It's the husband, the wife, and the father. And as the husband and wife are on their knees before the Lord, they're never closer than when they're, you know, one before Christ.
Mm-hmm. Reminds me of one of my pastors, his wife, I was talking to her and she was saying that when they went through marriage counseling or through their premarital counseling, I guess it is, she was asking their pastor, who was well respected, for all these tips and tactics, what do you think about couples devotions? Should we just do couples devotions? And he's like, don't even bother. He said, don't do it if you're not doing your own. He mm-hmm. said, because first you need to both be focused on the Lord and what you're getting from the Lord yourselves. And don't think that, just reading a little scripture together, like it was some kind of little formula that they were going to do and have this awesome marriage. And he said, remember the relationship with the Lord first, because he's going to provide things that you cannot get elsewhere.
Well, and marriage really is a crucible. It's hard to be married. I think people in the best marriages will say, man, there are days when it is just excruciating. But that is part of God's plan for shaping us and making us more like him, because you're never closer to anyone than when you're married to them.
It really shows you your heart.
Absolutely. And then, throw a couple of kids into the mix and boy, you're forced
you're
to be
real
honest.
Mess.
Yeah, you thought you were a good person.
It's easy to be married to me because I'm great.
I think some of when we hear about, that longing and the desire to be married, of maybe a dangerous longing is because it will make me happy. But maybe a healthier longing is not only do I want that companionship, but I want God to teach me how to love in the most intimate way.
Right.
And
well, like Gary Thomas says, maybe God didn't design marriage to make us happy, but to make us holy. Mm-hmm. But I think even Gary would say there are a lot of days where his marriage does make him happy. And so that's okay. I enjoy good food, and God has given us good food to satisfy our hunger. That doesn't mean we just eat, bread and just drink water. I like a little Godiva now and then. But obviously, you don't want to OD on the Godiva. So marriage can bring you happiness. But if that's the goal you're focusing on, if that's the moving target, you're going to be off balance. The focus has to be the Lord. And then you can be in balance in other areas. But marriage can make you happy.
Jackie, I've invited you into the studio to join us. You've been sitting behind the glass, and you're an employee here at Focus on the Family. And this topic hits you squarely between the eyes because you're a single woman who longs to be married and invited you in just to ask some of the questions and give some comments that you have on this topic.
Well, as I was listening, I noticed that one thing that you were talking about was that in the church is kind of making it shameful for single women to talk about their desire to be married. And I have always felt, and you can tell me what you think about this, that it's not because it's shameful because we long to get married. It's kind of shameful because I feel like the church has almost made us feel like second-class citizens or second-class Christians. Like, well, you're not married. What are you doing wrong? What are you not doing? What's wrong with you?
Jackie, I think there was a trend in many churches back in maybe the 70s at the height of the divorce revolution to do what they could to really make singles feel whole in the Lord, to help bind up some of those wounds and mend the brokenness. And that's when the singles group really got going. And so a lot of those groups were focused on ministering to singles who had been married. And a lot of what we're talking about today applies to women and men who have never been married. And unfortunately, it seems like a lot of pastors are uncomfortable doing anything proactive to help singles married because I think they're so afraid that they're going to offend that quote-unquote population. I don't know many churches where there's a lot of pressure to marry or certainly anything proactive to help people who want to get married married. There almost seems to be the opposite of, oh, we're totally hands-off and we just want to empower you. And to some extent, Lisa, you've talked about feeling like, boy, they don't want me to get married because then I wouldn't be able to volunteer on the weekend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there is that element of just kind of, well, two things. One, I think they're kind of afraid of us. I was in a mentoring group at my church, and I've said this on before on the Boundless Show, that a woman was going to mentor two of my single friends and I, and on the first meeting, she just said, I'm going to just tell you ladies, I'm just afraid of you. I don't even know what to do with single women. You are not my passion. My passion is to help young married women love their husbands. And so the three of us were just like, whoa, slammed in the face.
How did you feel when you heard that?
I was shocked. I just couldn't even believe that someone would voice that little, it's one thing to think it, but then to voice it to someone. It made me realize kind of the chasm that exists between the different life stages, even within a church, and how we're not doing a good, you know, it's singles are farmed out to the singles group. Mm-hmm. And that's just where you deal with, you know, your own demographic. And it can be kind of a blind leading the blind, because here we are trying to make good matches and get married, but we're dealing with kind of the same people that are, you know, carrying the same desires and in some ways the same baggage.
And I could certainly agree and see what you're saying, Jackie, in churches, that it's almost like when you get married, you've kind of graduated. Like, you made mm-hmm. it. You're one of us. Mm-hmm. You know, and although we need to hold marriage in high esteem, that kind of attitude is not right and it's not biblical.
Well, and it doesn't do anything to help singles who want to get married marry, because there's no practical, there's nothing concrete there. It's just an attitude.
And it adds shame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My sister thinks that the churches today give too many options to singles. She said, you know, she was married when she was 21, and she said, you know, Lisa, when this was back, I'm the youngest, so this was back in the 70s, and she said, when I got married, it was like you were done with college, and you either had to get married or else you were going to end up with, like, no friends, because everyone would marry, you know. And now you have Gen X groups, Gen Y groups, you know, college and career groups. You have groups based on all kinds of interests, you know, motorcycling or rappelling or whatever, and you just, all of a sudden, you're just scattered out and about, and there's no real concerted effort to say, okay, how are we going to help folks move along this life trajectory through college and then into young adulthood and eventually into marriage and family?
And my goal is certainly not to make singles feel bad about being single. It is to reach out to singles who want to get married and offer help and hope and vision and perspective on the culture we live in, because unfortunately, it doesn't just happen the way it used to. Just letting time pass does nothing to get you closer to marriage in our culture.
And so wouldn't, if, you know, for the women who have been, say, planning or living like they're planning to get married for 10 years, mm-hmm. 12 years, 15 years, isn't then the hard things, if you talk about, you know, pastors not wanting to address the hard things, wouldn't the hard thing be then to help them look at life as if they might not get married? It might not be part of God's plan for them.
Mm-hmm.
It might not be a gift that they receive from the Lord. He might have something else.
Definitely. And it might also be because the men in their lives were making such poor decisions and living in sin, whether it be with internet porn or cohabiting or many of the other choices out there, that some women, unfortunately, painfully, will stay single simply because of the brokenness of our culture and the way that our culture is. It seems like it specializes in relational brokenness right now.
Right. And that's a factor that's outside of so much of our control.
Definitely. Yeah.
And so how do you balance that with planning on getting married or living like you're planning to get married, but
right.
also having a realistic view that I can't make a guy ask me to marry him?
Well, and you wouldn't want that kind of guy.
No
bride wants to be at the altar saying, I got you.
Exactly.
Unless he has a lot of money and you can quit your job and just forget about it.
And he's 99.
No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, he's 99.
No.
Living like you're planning to marry, it does not mean you go out and buy a wedding dress. You don't hire the photographer and pick out your cake. It really overlaps with basic Christian discipleship. It's having a bold faith and growing in your relationship with the Lord. A key part of it is having an honor toward marriage and honoring men and not giving into or getting sucked into that sort of bash marriage and bash men. You know, that mindset that says, well, I'd rather be single and wish that I were married than be married and wish that I were single. I think that really takes singleness on its best day and pits it against marriage on its worst day. And there shouldn't be this competition or tension between the two. And we can't get what we dishonor. And so a really good starting point is to say, how do you relate to the men in your life? Because recall that what you want from them is the ultimate in intimacy. And they've been so wounded by the divorce that they see, and the, you know, they've, so many of them, half of them at least, have lost their fathers and the male role model. And so they're kind of floundering and don't really know what to do. And so I think there's an opportunity for single men and women to sort of nurture one another and spur one another on in this quest for marriage, but it also requires purity and stewardship and taking advantage of opportunities. And so again, living like you're planning to marry is not an obnoxious striving in your own strength for marriage. It's being intentional with an eye toward what you desire within the context of giving God glory. Your goal is marriage for His glory.
And I think, too, that there's nothing wrong with acknowledging a sadness in that. I mean, to, you know, to be going into your 30s and have wanted to be married and to not have that, I think there's this element that we find in Christian circles where it's like, well, just trust the Lord and be the good soldier and take on the Awana ministry, you know, and do and make up for it somehow, you know, and it doesn't make up for it. And I think, you know, I'm in a season now of 11 of my friends are getting married between now within a span of 6 months. And I'm independently happy for all of them. But there's an element of feeling left behind in this life stage now because they're moving on and they have new chapters and it's all great. And it's not that I don't trust the Lord any less or anything, but I think that we need to grieve the fact that there is a cultural singleness and a cultural malaise, and that there are women out there, you know, who have done, you know, made poor choices, and that there are men who are lame, and there are just things that are not right, and we need to acknowledge that.
Yeah, when you're talking about that grieving, and the grieving really comes from honoring marriage and knowing that it's a good thing, because you're grieving that you don't have it. What does that look like every day? When you walk into an apartment by yourself and you see friends get married and you're lonely on a weekend and the phone's not ringing, how does a woman walk through that grieving and honor God through it?
Yeah, I think for me, it's definitely been a process. And like I said, it seems to be for someone who, as I get older, it almost seems to be getting worse, because like I said, it was a few years ago where I finally realized, oh, maybe I do want to get married. And so I was like, whoa, what happened? The train missed me. But so I see that, and it kind of makes me wonder, you know, whoa, like what happened? At the same time, first of all, you know, let's be honest, there are a lot of coping mechanisms that you have. I mean, I do stay busy and I'm involved in things and I have great friendships and I make sure I cultivate those. But there is an element of recognizing that, you know, my dad is gone now. My mom is older. I had a relationship end a few months ago, and it just made me think to myself, what if my mom isn't even around when I eventually get married, if I ever do? And you have to look back and just realize there may be a lot of losses in this. There are already a lot of losses. I will never be married in my 20s. I will never have kids in my 20s. And that's something I've just had to reconcile myself towards. And I think there are just many things that women and men alike have to be realistic about in looking at this. You know, I have a friend who just got married a few weeks ago to a guy that she's known for 17 years. And they, you know, and she's just like, why did we not get married 17 years ago? What happened? Mm-hmm. And she can't answer those questions, and she never will be able to. And it's just a sadness that she has to recognize.
Yeah. I mean, I've certainly grieved with friends and wept and prayed with friends and said, I don't know. This isn't a, you know, this book is not a money-back guarantee. Because there are a lot of areas of our lives where we are faithful and we do our part, and then we have to step back and say, Lord, I've got to trust you for the rest. And it really is a walk of faith at that point. And it's not just in areas of marriage. Once you get married, then you have women who deal with infertility and the heartache and the grief of that. And then there are women who finally get married and have difficult marriages, or their husband loses a job, or a child has a disability. Or, I mean, life on this fallen planet is hard and broken. And so we do have to bring our cares and cast them at the feet of the Lord and just ask him for grace. And so there is an element of this that is just the, I don't know, I don't understand it. And someday when we get to heaven, we can say, God, why did that awesome, why do some women not marry? It's a heartache. And so, you know, if we can do anything to encourage the younger women, don't squander opportunities, and the older women to say, press into the Lord and take advantage of opportunities and ask your community to support you in prayer. And if you know someone great, introduce us, but walk with me and don't leave me alone in this, then it will have been worth it.
Love is not proud. Love does not boast. Love, after all, matters the most. Love does not run. Love does not hide. Love does not keep locked inside. Love is a river that flows through. And love never fails,
love will not cease at the end of time, and love will protect. Love always hopes, and love still believes when you don't. Love is the arms that are holding you. Love never fails you.
For this week's culture segment, I'm in the studio again with Dr. Al Mohler. For those of you that remember, I chatted with Dr. Mohler at New Attitude last spring, and I think we kidnapped him in a back hallway somewhere behind the convention center and put him at this long table, and people were slamming doors and walking on either side of us, and he was gracious enough to sit down and talk to us about all manners of things. And he is back today because he's at Focus on the Family. So welcome, Dr. Mohler.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Yay. Well, you have so many fans here at the Boundless Show, and Boundless, the webzine and the blog, and I know that you follow us a little bit.
Absolutely.
You know kind of what we're doing. The young adult demographic here in the evangelical world, and we try to, you know, kind of keep our finger on the pulse of what folks are thinking, and, you know, sometimes have to issue a few rebukes, we feel, you know, but...
Well, that's true in every generation.
Yeah. That's mostly me. I just rebuke people because it's one of my gifts. Is that an okay gift to have, do you think?
I don't think it's listed as a gift, but perhaps, you know, then again, we all know it's necessary.
It could. It's one of those special ones. I feel like, you know, just no.
It is listed, by the way, of course, when what Paul tells Timothy is his task in terms of teaching and preaching the word. Rebuke is very much in that list.
See people? Okay, well, first of all, I have to thank you for accepting me as your Facebook friend, because you did that this week. So I'm now one of his friends, which is exciting. I'm there are only about 4,000 of us, so I feel, you know, just part of a small group.
It's a challenge because Facebook limits you to 5,000.
What
and
are you
going
to do?
I've got more requests than I can take. And so I'm just trying to, you know, just given the fact that I have a school with students and friends and a radio program with listeners, I'm just trying to connect with the right people that I can have probably the greatest conversation with. And yet that's hit or miss. You know, it's one of the interesting things about social media. Your introduction is often based upon a very little piece of information about how you're related to them through someone else.
Oh, that's true. Yes, that is true. Now, you don't have some kind of special pass, though? Do you have like a petition to go in to say, look, I am Al Mohler and I need more than 5,000 friends. Let's be honest here.
Well, Facebook tells us they're working towards that. As a matter of fact, the CEO said they would like to be able to have 100,000 friends. But the problem is right now, given the massive growth of Facebook, which is exponential in terms of their users, they're really not in a position to do that yet. There are fan pages. So, for instance, the Albert Mohler program has what they call a fan page. No one has used that as effectively as Barack Obama did. Now, President Obama, during the presidential campaign, when Senator then Obama put up a Facebook presence that frankly is has changed the world of politics.
Yeah, that is true.
Those are unlimited in terms of how many people can sign up.
Right. I do not think a fan page has yet been created for me, and I'm a little bitter about that. So those of you who are listening, please get one up immediately. But all that said, I did want to talk to you a little bit about new media and about those of us who are involved in the world of new media. Now, my day job here at Focus is in PR and media relations, and we are actually considering bringing someone on board who specializes in targeting new media from a PR perspective, just because we know that to be so important. Like, we can go on and search anything related to Focus in Wikipedia and just find countless errors, because we know that you can just go in and make up, you know, start entering information. So we're finding, you know, how are we going to track that kind of stuff? How are we going to track mentions on blogs and pages and forums? And how are we going to go into some of the social networking sites like Facebook and MySpace and find a presence there, especially for young adults? What have you seen, Dr. Mohler, as far as evangelicals doing that well and maybe not so well?
Well, I think the not so well is certainly probably where to start, because most are slow adopters of this kind of technology. Some by principle. I mean, there's some people that fear it, that think that it's non-personal, perhaps even anti-personal. Some just fear the kind of connectivity that comes with all of this. You know, I have to tell you, I see it as a tremendous opportunity. And I think the way that evangelicals need to look at social media is the way we would look at any kind of culture. It's a culture unto itself. And we know with a Great Commission kind of mindset, we're to look at any culture, any society, any people group and say, we need to have a presence there for the sake of the gospel of Christ and for the sake of a Christian presence to convey Christian truth. And so I see social media as a vast new continent, and it doesn't replace everything that came before it. I mean, still in terms of the most authoritative kinds of communication, you know, your lawyer generally does not communicate with you by Facebook. Mm-hmm. You know, you're still going to have letters, you're going to have documents, you're going to have email and all the rest. But social media provides a quantum opportunity to really leverage influence. That's the way I put it, is a quantum opportunity to leverage influence.
Hmm.
And that's because you're communicating with people. And and not just in terms of putting something like on a bulletin board people may see, you're actually related electronically, digitally to people and who are related to others. And the next thing you know, there really is a new presence.
Yeah. And I think it's fascinating just because I was telling some friends this the other day that just by virtue of Facebook, I have reconnected with a lot of high school and college friends. Mm-hmm. And you know, my first thought was, I don't know that I want to connect with these people. Like, that was a long time ago, and I can hardly keep up with the friends that I have. But I have had some great conversations with friends from high school who brought, like, one of my friends brought up a conversation. She sent me a message, and she was like, you know, I remember you from high school, and I remember you being a person of faith, I think she described me. And she said, you know, now I've seen in some of your posts and some of your links and whatever that you are a Christian. And she just began this dialogue that we had where I was able to share the gospel with her. And I mean, it's just, it's neat how I would have never thought that that would have happened.
You know, I wrote an article about Facebook on its anniversary, fifth anniversary, hard to believe it's only 5 years old. but on the fifth anniversary of Facebook, I tried to think about, okay, now, what are the gains and what are the losses in this? There are dangers. You know, as a parent, I have to say, I look at Facebook as the kind of dark continent that I'm not ready to let my kids go in alone. And I have very strong words to parents about supervising and managing the kind of social media involvement of their children and teenagers. I also know there are people whose lives get wrapped up so that they're really living more in that world 2.0 or web 2.0 than in the real world, where quite frankly, relationships demand a lot more of us. One of the reasons why people like the relatedness that comes through social media is because if something goes wrong, if the conversation gets too taxing, too costly, if it gets too close to the marrow of the bone, you turn them off or you get up from your computer and walk away. And that is not the way it is with real life. You can't parent that way. You can't be married that way. And you really can't develop long-lasting, substantial relationships in the same way through social media. That's not to say it's not an important new dimension of life.
Right. Yeah, it's like if you're going to solve conflict on Facebook, you throw a snowball at someone, which, you know, isn't the same as real life. It's not as, not as necessary. So
sometimes better, but you know, but when, what we're looking at here is the fact that this is a new reality. It's not like anything that human beings have actually done before. We're not passing, you know, clay tablets with words written on them. We're not just publishing books or talking to each other on the phone. Now there's this ability to put real life stuff up there. Through postings, to share photographs, videos, and put together affinity groups and things like that that pull people in. And that's what's really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. So how do you think, I mean, as Christians of all people, we should be the ones that are most in people's lives and most dealing with real relationships. But at the same time, we want to be relevant and we want to be able to access all these different portals of info and ways of communicating. So what's a good way to balance that?
Well, I think a good way to balance it is to imagine how you actually spend your time. If most of your time is spent in a digital world, there's something fundamentally wrong because we weren't made in the image of God in order to spend most of our time in that kind of digital engagement. We were made to have face-to-face conversations. We were made to have intimate and personal relationships where the accountability is on a whole new scale from what you have in the digital world. But at the same time, I think that really could play the other way as well. If you're ignoring a vast new continent of people before you, you really probably better do a reality check about your concern for the gospel.
Hmm. That's true, yeah. Okay, well, we did mention how our new president, President Obama, has done well using social media. He did it in the campaign and promises to continue to use it, continue to use younger folks to get his message across and build his audience and certainly support for the plans that he has. What was your take on any thoughts on the speech, on the State of the Union and the response? Kind of what was your feeling about that?
Well, you know, officially it wasn't a State of the Union, although it sure had the look and feel of it.
It was funny how everyone, that's how everyone is, yeah. They're just calling it State of the Union.
Well, and it looked like
the first 3 weeks, that was great.
And you look at it and you say, well, number one, he had a tremendous opportunity there, but he also had a daunting challenge. The subject matter of his presentation really defy the leadership challenge. What are you going to get up and say when actually you're not controlling everything that takes place? And there's a danger. I mean, honestly, every time the president speaks right now, there's a danger the stock market's going to go down another 80 to 300 points based just upon the trauma of people trying to figure out, okay, how does that play out? You know, I think it's another illustration, though, the fact that what you had there was a man, President Obama, standing before other human beings. And there's the drama of watching that take place. It wouldn't have been the same speech if he had just given this on the radio. So I think it shows that even in a world of new media, by the way, there's still very much a distinction between what he could have put on his Facebook page, what he could communicate through a blog or a podcast, and what it meant to see him standing there in the well of the House of Representatives at the podium, the vice president and the Speaker of the House behind him. The drama of all of that, the reality, the choreography, the color, the drama, all that can't be replicated in new media. But the most interesting conversations about what took place in new media. I think that's what's really happening, is that new media, social media, this becomes the place where the conversation is going on. And I want to be a part of that conversation. I think that's one of the things interesting about President Obama. He wants to be a part of that conversation.
Mm-hmm. And I like how he's ask the questions well, and he's done it in so many different formats. And I think what you're saying is so true, how, you know, pre-cameras, pre-whatever, he would have been talking to Congress, and, you know, right. It would have been in a closed room, people just sitting there in their suits talking. But really, he was speaking to the nation and beyond. And like you said, I mean, that speech will continue on through the conversation that's going
Absolutely.
On, going on beyond it. So, well, that's fascinating.
You know, I was sitting in a meeting during the speech. I had to watch the speech after it went on. I was in a very intense session. I could not leave, but I had my iPhone, and my iPhone was going off. I received over 100 tweets. Mm-hmm. From friends watching the speech. And so I was being fed all this information in response, and I was able to quickly pull it up on my iPhone, you know, the image of and understand a little bit about what was going on there. I would like to have watched it when it took place. That just wasn't possible. But I was able to see the whole thing afterwards. And, you know, I realized that my hearing or observation of that speech, well, it wasn't the same experience as if I hadn't seen it before reading all those tweets, you know, up on Twitter, because that's another thing about social media. Social media changes the frame of how people understand events.
Yeah, it definitely does. And everyone is able to weigh in and kind of shape how people are going to see. You know, if you hear about something, how something's playing out before you even see it. And we could talk about, you know, a presidential speech, or we could talk about what's going on American Idol or The Bachelor, for that matter. I mean, this is, you know, I have friends that are talking about both.
And you don't necessarily know who you're talking to about it, so to speak. For instance, I was in I received a Facebook contact, someone asking a question. I can't deal with all those, but this one looked really interesting. And so I took it up on the radio program, the question that was asked. And the next thing you knew, I had a little back and forth going. Lots of people joined in. I found out, in the midst of doing the program, in the midst of answering the question, this is a 17-year-old young man in London. Mm-hmm. And there I was sitting in Louisville, Kentucky in my studio, and all of a sudden I've got a worldwide conversation going on before me. It takes three screens to do this because, by the way, I'm doing radio now with Facebook and Twitter going contemporaneous. So I've got all these screens before me. And what we're discovering is that you've got a different demographic. The people who call in, who are most likely to call in, are most likely to be 55 or above. The people who will communicate by Facebook and Twitter are anywhere from 14 to, you know, 30. And I want those people involved in my program. And so it's fun to be able to do that by Twitter, by Facebook. And in between those two cohorts, you got email.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, you are obviously pulled in many different directions. For those of you who don't know, Dr. Moeller is actually in town because he's part of our Focus board meetings this week, and I know there's been a lot of activity there, and obviously you have the seminary, you have, you know, your show, you've got a lot going on. Obviously, keeping up with, you know, Twitter, it's just a full-time job. What are some of your, in kind of looking at the scope of your life and what, you know, what you have going on day-to-day, and then, you know, even longer range, looking at 09, Dr. Moeller, what are some of your priorities professionally? Like, how are you keeping it all straight? And really, what professionally and then personally, what are some priorities that you see?
Well, in terms of you gave the order as professionally first. My first responsibility is as president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Boyce College, and this marks the 150th year. It's a big year for us. And as you may know, we're a part of the economy along with everyone else. So even as we are gearing up to celebrate this big sesquicentennial, and no one knew the seminary grew to have, you know, well over 4,500 students. Who would have known? But we're also facing some real challenges. We're in a good position. The Lord's been gracious to us. Our friends have been generous with us. But in this time of financial dislocation, we're all trying to figure out, okay, how do we do more with less, and how do we do better, you know, under this circumstance? I really like that old economic adage, don't waste a crisis. And I really think that's very important. We don't want to waste a crisis. This is a good opportunity to maximize what we're doing. The radio program, the web presence, and all the rest, we're just hoping this will be a good year to be able to be refining, focused. I'm doing my own content analysis, asking some other people to do the same, because we don't want to just talk about the same things over and over again. On the other hand, I'll tell you, the issues that come to me from callers, from Facebook, from email, mail, old snail mail, they're still the recurring issues. So that seems to be very much a constant. Personally, my wife and I, Mary and I, are at a great stage of life. We just celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary. I've got a 19-year-old daughter who's a college sophomore, about to finish her second year, and a 16-year-old son, about to turn 17. He's here at Focus with me this week and having a good time being here in Colorado Springs. It's a good time for us. And I think in terms of keeping everything in balance, you know, I'll be honest, not every day's in balance. And one of the things you have to admit is that we're not in control, you know, of a lot of things that happen. You know, you think a meeting's going to be over at 5, it's not. You think, you know, this is a day you're going to be able to do X, Y, and Z, and the next thing you know, someone dies in the morning, you got to, you know, you got to deal with that. Being in ministry is a real challenge because I also have a pastoral responsibility, and so that sometimes changes the schedule. But over time, the Lord gives you wisdom to balance these things out, and not just alone. It takes some people around me who can look at my life, speak into my life, and say, you know, maybe you need to balance this over here a little bit. And that's by the way, one of the reasons why being married is so healthy. I can speak from a man's perspective, because I would just miss a whole lot if I didn't have a woman who is my dear wife, who loves me and whom I love, to say, hey, look, no one else is going to tell you this, so I'm going to tell you this. And also, who just kind of, you know, keeps life on track. And I hope I do the same for her. I know she has to be better at keeping me on track than I am keeping her on track, because she has a laser-like focus on things. I think all men have ADD. And so we're a little more scattered. And I kind of like the scattered life I get to live, doing, you know, things all over the place. But you really do need some time just to sit back and say, all right, do an inventory of life. You know, are we really doing what God would have us to do?
Do you ever find yourself caught in the trap of comparing yourself to other people, whether it's, you know, whether it's other Christian leaders or the guy down the street or...
You know, I'll be honest and say, I don't have that problem in terms of someone who I just look at and say, I'd trade places with him. I really don't have that temptation. Where it comes out in my life is, you know, whether it's in media involvement or writing, you know, I'm constantly writing books and articles, or whether it's you know, speaking, or, you know, the administration of the seminary or college. There are always things you look at and you say, boy, I really wish... At some aspect of life and some dimension of life, there's someone I think is really doing an outstanding job. And so, yeah, you always compare some of those things. And not all of that is bad, by the way. Not all of that is bad. You don't know if you're doing well if you have no point of comparison. And we ought to want to do well for the glory of God. On the other hand, if that becomes an obsession, and if it leads to a real sense of envy or something like that, then of course it becomes perverse. But in reality, you know, the reason why athletes get better is because the competition's better. And that's not all bad.
Okay, Dr. Moeller, I always finish, I say always because I've interviewed you once before. So eventually when you make us your first priority after Jesus and your family, then we're going to have you on here at least once a week. So, but until then, just tell us the most fun thing that you've done in the last month.
The most fun thing I have done in the last month was to go and stand on the Theodosian walls of Istanbul.
Oh, my word.
To stand in the ruins of Constantinople and imagine that I was standing there where three different civilizations have found their capital. And if ever you want to understand the way that life quickly turns to sand, all you have to do is stand on walls built 1,000 years ago and imagine that the walls stood, but what they were supposed to protect did not. You know, standing there. And by the way, the most amazing thing I've had happen recently was being in some Muslim-dominated parts of the world and coming to terms with what I think is going to be one of the fundamental challenges faced by Christians in the century ahead.
Hmm. That's fascinating. Wow. Okay, well, we always enjoy having you here on The Boundless Show, Dr. Moeller. Thank you so much for joining us today, stepping out of what just, I'm sure, has seemed like an interminable series of meetings that you've had. At least you get to look at the mountains once in a while.
You know, it's hard to complain when you look out and see Pike's Peak on a clear day. And it's great to be here with you.
Pike's Peak on a clear day, that's the way it's done. Which reminds me, Boundless fans, you need to come out and visit us here at Focus on the Family. I can't promise that Dr. Moeller will be here at the same time you are, but if he is, we'll just attack him and I don't know what. You can just ask him questions personally. So until then, we'll hopefully have the opportunity to talk to you again, Dr. Moeller, but thank you for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure to be with you. I believe in Boundless and what you're doing. Keep at it.
Yay. Inbox. I'm in the studio with Steve Waters. Hey, Steve.
Hey.
Here we are. Isn't it a nice day today?
It is.
It's a very nice
you know,
day.
When this airs, it could be snowing, so.
Yeah, it could in Colorado. So
but we're enjoying recording day.
We are, and it's good weather here in the studio. So anyway, here's a question. We're going to open this up. I alluded to it at the beginning of the show, but our young friend says, I am a longtime Boundless listener and a college grad wanting to pursue marriage. I've read Boundless articles about how you shouldn't let finances stop you from marrying or starting a family. I would have agreed with you wholeheartedly until the recent economic downturn. Now I'm not so sure. I have been unable to get a job other than food service since I graduated. I live with my parents because I cannot support myself, much less a wife. I'm still actively seeking higher wage earning employment, but it seems like there's nothing on the horizon. I have friends who are in the same boat. Does your advice to get married and start a family still hold true in times of economic difficulty like we're facing now? Should I pursue marriage and trust God will provide the means, or should I gain some stability first?
Oh, this is a good question. Historically, people have always had marriage and starting families tied to the economic surroundings. And then that's why when you look at the age of first marriage, age of first child, historically, it's always been tied to the economy. The biggest plummet was during the Great Depression, that you had people waiting until late 20s into their 30s to get married and start a family because it was taking them that much longer to get the stability he's talking about and be able to have a good foundation for starting. And that whole idea of going away and being prepared for family, you know, even in the Bible where they talk about, I'll go away and prepare a place for you. When Jesus says that, it's something that everybody's familiar with in the Hebrew culture, because every time a young man was going to get married, he would go away and actually build the house they're going to live in. And there was all this physical preparation that would take place. And you can imagine even then, if they had a famine, if they had some kind of persecution or political issues, there would be delays that would keep people from being able to do the actual preparation they need to make. And you read through the Bible and you know that God cares about stewardship, about us being wise with the responsibilities we have. But he also talks about being faithful in little, of making the most of the little that we do have, and that as we're faithful with that, that he can multiply it and use it. And so I think what we are seeing now is that people are going to have to work a little harder, that there might be a certain amount of delays. What we would encourage people to have as a check in mind is to realize that you can always imagine greener financial pastures. It's always easy to think, if I just wait a little bit longer and a little bit longer, then it'll be even better of a position. And that when it comes to marriage and kids, there is quite a bit of preparation that needs to be in place, but you shouldn't get into that trap of thinking it's always going to be better the later and later you wait, because then you're also dealing with other timing issues, and especially things like fertility is going to be important. So I think the key thing at this point is being a good steward, recognizing too that stretched timeline could result in some extra sexual temptation, and that it is very important to be pure and to emphasize being pure, realizing that you might reach a point where it's better to marry than to burn. But to realize that as you're faithful, as you're pure, as you're a good steward with the little that you do have, that yes, then God is faithful, but it's not a matter of just jumping out there blindly getting married without doing that preparation and that stewardship on the front end.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think this guy should do? Because he's obviously underemployed. He's saying he can't. I mean, if he's living with his parents, that's not a point where you can pursue marriage.
Well, I think faithful in little reminds us that we're always called to spend less than we bring in, that everybody at any income level is in a position that they can be a steward with what they have and spend less. But that we also have a stewardship responsibility. We've talked on this on the show before about any job you have, whether you're emptying trash cans or you're a CEO, you've got a stewardship responsibility. And as you are faithful, people will give you additional opportunities. Now, once again, in this current economic challenge, that opportunity could come a little later. It might not be quite as lucrative, but that typically people who are faithful are giving more responsibilities, people who are faithful with little. And so if he's in food service, then he should seek to be the best food service worker he can possibly be, and then also be faithful with the talents that God's given him with his time, spending with mentors and networking and looking for other opportunities to use the gifts and talents God's given him in greater and greater responsibilities.
Okay. So, but if he wants to pursue someone right now, if he has someone in mind when he's writing this, should he pursue her? Because I'm thinking, I don't know what food service means. If he's talking about he works at McDonald's or if he's talking about whatever. So, I mean, if he approaches her and she knows his situation, he might get turned down because of that if he's living with his parents and stuff. So how do we keep him from getting too discouraged, but at the same time giving him reality and just saying, you know, whoa.
I think this is one of those cases where he can demonstrate his love for someone. If he has someone in mind, demonstrate his love by his faithful pursuit of being in a position of provision. I love the movie Sergeant York, and you see Gary Cooper, and he's crazy about this one girl. But he knows that he needs to buy a farm and get his own place. And it just shows him working so hard to try to win her love by demonstrating that he can care for her, especially because he had a reputation of being a wild kid who wasn't responsible. And I just love to see that effort and energy he poured into that. And I think we used to see a lot more of that, of people who would scramble and would work hard to show that they are ready and faithful. And I think that communicates a lot to the family of a future wife that shows that you are being responsible, that they're not worried that they're going to have to step in and be a major safety net for this marriage. Mm. And so I think the challenge of the economy we have right now is going to require more resourcefulness and creativity. But I think that also is going to give people an opportunity to demonstrate their love, their passion for another person. And I think we're going to have some interesting stories of how people found a way to get through it and still form marriages and families that were meaningful even in these challenging times.
Hmm. Yeah. And I'm not saying that this listener reflects this, but I think there is that mindset. I mean, we need to make sure that we're not in the mindset of, the economy's bad, so it's going to take longer for someone to come along and offer me a better job. That is right. Not where you need to be. It does create, you know, it does involve a lot of hard work, pounding the pavement, intentionality, networking, stuff like that. And he can devote a lot of his, you know, time and attention to that.
Absolutely.
Pursuing there, getting practice, pursuing a job, then pursuing her. Well, thanks, right. Steve, for yeah. weighing in on that. So, okay, well, as always, we want to hear from you with your questions and your comments at editor@boundless.org. Make sure that you are part of our conversation and talking to us and giving us your feedback. We always want that. So we're in the middle of creating a bunch of new shows, so make sure you stick around and that you catch up on old ones if you haven't listened to them. I know a lot of you are doing that and listening in big blocks on road trips, so that is awesome as well. We will have fresh content for you next week, and until then, I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.